Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This holiday season, choose gifts that feel thoughtful and practical with Omaha Steaks. Whether you're hosting or gifting, they deliver the world's best steak experience, and it makes you look like you planned way ahead. They've got USDA-certified tender steaks, juicy burgers, comfort meals, and tons more. Gifting Omaha Steaks is honestly one of the easiest wins. Everything arrives beautifully packaged, super convenient, and the quality is unbelievable. Their filet mignons are some of the most tender I've ever had. And the variety means you can personalize every gift. Plus, orders placed by 6 p.m. Eastern ship same day. And everything is backed by their 100% guarantee. It's holiday gifting made simple. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their Sizzle All The Way sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code T-Bone at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, code T-Bone.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with somebody that you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One.
A lot of people describe squash as physical chess because you have to put the ball in certain areas and think ahead several shots in advance and create situations where you are in an advantage. It's a very cerebral game and it happens very fast.
And our guest this week is Nikki Clement. She is the head men's and women's squash coach at Haverford College. And before we start anything, Nikki, thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Matt. Thanks for having me.
So as we are taping this right around the holidays, where are you in your season? I mean, obviously, semester, you're between semesters school-wise, but squash-wise, are you about halfway through? This is kind of the middle part of the regular season for squash?
Yes, you are absolutely right. We started our season at the end of October, and the students just left for the break this week. And then they'll be back in 3 weeks to do the second half.
Let's talk a little bit about squash, the sport itself. I think it is a sport that is on the upswing, but I also think it is a sport that a lot of people aren't familiar with. If you had to explain to me or to somebody the sport of squash, give me the elevator pitch.
Sure. So it, first of all, is one of the most fun games in the world. It is played in a court that is 32 feet by 21 feet, and it is played with usually one other person. There's singles and doubles, but typically it's singles, one against another person, and There, you have a racket and you have a ball that's about an inch and a half in diameter, and it is a rubber. It's rubber and it's very bouncy. And essentially, what you're doing is you're hitting the ball against the front wall, and your partner does the same exact thing in response. And it's really just the last person to keep the ball in play. And it is a lot of fun when you are a beginner, but the more complicated it gets, the even more fun that it gets.
When you say complicated, what do you mean?
You know, just being able to control the ball a lot more and being able to do something with intention and putting tactics into the game. A lot of people describe squash as physical chess because you have to put the ball in certain areas and think ahead several shots in advance and create situations where you are in an advantage or get out of situations when you are on defense. So it's a very cerebral game and it happens very fast. It's very high paced and you're essentially sprinting around a court constantly to, you know, reach the next ball. And it's very, you need a lot of explosive movement and also a lot of hand-eye coordination. So there's a lot going on. And like I said, the more advanced you get, the more longer the points are and the more that there's going on in these points. I think you could probably relate that to tennis too, for those of us that are trying to, you know, learn more about squash.
And to the point of the points, is there a time limit or are you playing to a certain point total?
You are playing to 11 points. That's one game. And the first person to get three games wins the match.
So you're career in squash. What's your origin story? How did you get exposed to the sport? Where did it all start for you?
Yeah. So my parents were big players in the, you know, this Philadelphia area. My dad would take my brother and I to his league matches. You know, he would have matches in the evenings. And I remember he'd pick up McDonald's for us on the way. And then we'd just sit in the, you know, gallery eating and as he played his league match. And it was just that way for a long time. We were just exposed to it at a really young age. And then we got into it more seriously when, you know, we were in elementary school and middle school. You know, we were playing all kinds of sports, but we were, you know, also playing a lot of squash just because we got exposed to it. And then, you know, I started to do a lot of clinics and one-on-one lessons and then started doing junior tournaments, which is junior just refers to, you know, players under 18. So a lot of tournaments in the area and then tournaments in Boston and New York and Baltimore and just kind of, playing as much as I could because I really did fall in love with the game at a young age. So just being exposed to it by my family and then having access to courts was how it all happened.
Were you really good right away or did you fall in love with the sport and then the special ability developed? Or I guess it's kind of a chicken egg question. You obviously understood the sport watching, you know, parents, were you really good at first or was the fact that you were exposed to it led you to interest it? And then the more you played it, you got really good.
Yeah. You know, I really loved the game and I loved hitting a ball and I loved everything about learning. I wanted to perfect my swing and I wanted to, there's a social element too. You know, I was playing with kids my age and going to these clinics and, I loved getting the one-on-one from coaches. And, you know, I didn't realize I was decent until college. So I was just focused on, you know, wanting to just getting better and really just perfecting it as much as I could, the tactics of it, the technical side of it. And, you know, I wasn't really thinking about the other side of it as much, because I was just so fixated on getting good. And I lost a lot when I was young, absolutely, because it is such a mental game. And a lot of people, what I've noticed is a lot of adults who start it, or college kids who start it, they have this learning curve of getting used to playing with no other teammates to rely on and having to make very quick decisions over and over and over, and being able to respond emotionally in the right way when things don't go well. So it's such a mental game. And no matter where you started as a kid, as an adult, there's a huge learning curve with the mental side of it. So I think I was dealing with that and being really hard on myself and, not having, the confidence. So I was not winning when I was a kid. And then, maybe seeing a little bit of results here and there, but I really loved the game so, so much that I just always went back the next day to keep working on it.
I was listening to an interview you did somewhere else. Did you have a brother that you played with a lot growing up?
Yes. Yes. I have two brothers, and my older brother was also really into squash. So, he was my partner when we would, be practicing during the week and weekends. And, obviously our family would all go to tournaments and that sort of stuff. And then also he was the number one at Bowdoin when I was looking at colleges, and I ended up at the same place. So we also ended up kind of playing alongside each other there also.
How much did that help, whether it's a sibling rivalry in you're beating each other, or just the relationship pushes you, from a competitive standpoint, not against so much maybe him as just having someone to always measure yourself against. How much was that? How big was that in your development as a player?
That's a cool question. I think that my brother and I played with my dad a lot. My younger brother and mom would jump in too sometimes. But I think having that relationship, in this case with my brother, we both just, it was never contentious. And, he's 2 years older than me, and he's a guy and I'm a girl, so he's going to beat me. And, when there were moments that I, beat him, it wasn't contentious. We both just wanted to, we were very lucky to have guidance, to play with sportsmanship and always have, just that mindset of generous play towards your opponent. And it definitely played a role in that I had a partner all the time. I hit a lot by myself because you really do need to hit be on court on your own a lot to, like I said earlier, fix your swing and master certain mechanics. But it was great to have a partner all the time. And we both just were very serious when we were playing, drilling, competing, very serious about getting better and focusing on, did we get, a little bit better? Did this work? Did this not? And so I think that really helped us prevent burnout and just continue to love the game and what it brought out, in us.
You went to Radnor High School, am I correct?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Was there a squash team there? At like a Radnor High squash team?
Right. So there was not. There is a team there now. A lot of public schools are creating squash programs, which is such good news. That needs to be happening so that more kids are exposed to the sport. But at the time, Radnor was very big in sports in general. And I played lacrosse there and I played soccer there. And I was very serious about those sports. But I just, during the winter, I went, after school, I went right over to the club and squash club, and I was there till the evening. And I was just there hitting, playing with partners or by myself, and maybe, doing homework outside of the courts if I didn't do that when I got home. But we really, we went to school and then we went to the club after every day to hit.
How difficult was the, because I mean, when, if there's a school team, you know, there's a structure, you're, you know, you go out for the team, this team plays these seven surrounding schools, and if you're the champion, was it hard to find competition at that level where you would be a part of a club team, stuff like that? And also, you know, the sport wasn't as popular then right. as it is now. Was that a challenge for you and your parents to find pipelines to play for, from a competitive standpoint?
You know, it wasn't, because the club scene is so much bigger than the school scene, or at least it was. The club squash scene was way bigger. So most people were in that boat. So, you know, there were kids at from 3 o'clock until 8 o'clock going to their squash and fitness club Monday through Friday. And then those clubs would host junior events. So they would host tournaments. And so all the kids in that in Philly are going to the same five clubs every, you know, every weekend, or we're all going to the one in Boston, or there's a couple in, you know, this city this weekend. So that club squash scene was bigger. So, in fact, even nowadays, kids who play at schools, they sometimes miss out on the junior events because they have squash practice at school. So it's actually kind of the opposite of what you might have been thinking. Hopefully we can get just a nice healthy balance where schools offer it and their programs are really serious, and then, you know, kids can go to their clubs in the, on the weekends or in the afternoons to get more one-on-one with, you know, teaching pros. So that actually we were very, we and my brother and I and all the kids in this area hit it playing. We were lucky because squash is pretty big in Philly, which might sound surprising to some listeners, but it's, you know, one of those sports where when you do figure it out, then you are in that community and it's everywhere. So squash was very big in Philly, and now it's going to be even bigger now that the U.S. National Center is right downtown on between 34th and 33rd on Market. So there's a huge public national center there now. Anybody listening, please go check it out. You can walk in and learn about the game and try it out. But Philly is getting even bigger and with squash. And at the time, I was lucky that there was a lot of clubs in this area offering those junior events every weekend all year.
Now, that's really interesting, because sounds to me, it's kind of like the bizarro college basketball, and the idea that the AAU is the thing that was really established. It's the school leagues that were trying to fight for position and trying to get the athletes to get. That's really interesting.
Yeah, 100%. Sounds exactly like that. And, you know, hopefully we can really get some, you know, some more balance. I think it's been great. It was great to have that. And I think that we can keep that going, because those clubs continue. They're still booming. You know, they're holding events all the time.
So you mentioned earlier, your brother went to Bowdoin, you went to Bowdoin. Were you sold through his experience? Were there other schools that you looked at? Were you recruited a lot? Were you recruited from a squash standpoint? Did other schools come along and say, we'd like you to play first? Kind of what was that journey like?
Yeah. So my brother ended up at Bowdoin, and he was 2 years ahead of me. And I thought, there's no way that I'm going to the same school as my brother. So I looked around at other schools and visited other schools, did overnights at other schools. And you know, it got to the point where Bowdoin was, I was very serious about it. So I called him up. He was at school up in Maine, and I was down here, and I called him and I said, you got to be honest with me right now. What would you think if I, you know, matriculated at Bowdoin? And he was like, you got to come. It's going to be so much fun. We're going to have like the two teams, you know, because he was be on the men's team, I would be on the women's teams. Like, we bring the teams together. We'd have so much fun. We could train. You got to do it. So that's sort of how that happened. And then I, you know, in the years later, I remember thinking, oh, you know, all I've done is follow my brother's footsteps and I just keep copying him. And I was talking to, you know, a family member who said, you know, it's actually not that. It's just you two are very similar and you have similar interests. And so I think we were the same aspects of Bowdoin were appealing to both of us. And so it's sort of, I think, because we are similar in a lot of ways, that's sort of why that happened.
And Bowdoin's up in Maine, correct?
Yes. Yes. It's in Portland, Maine, which is right after the border of New Hampshire, right near the beach.
So you had mentioned how you had traveled for tournaments and stuff like that. But, you know, Maine's far away. It's probably, what, 9 hours by car, nine-ish in that ballpark. How'd you do? I mean, your brother's there. Obviously, that helps a lot with the transition. But, you know, how, you know, at first, how was it going to college that far away?
It was great. I wanted to be somewhere new and I got that. So it was really fun. I met all kinds of new people and I was in this beautifully green environment with, you know, mountains not far and water not far and just an amazing academic environment. It was a blast. It was a lot of fun.
You had mentioned earlier that, and correct me if I'm paraphrasing incorrectly, that it wasn't until college you kind of realized where your talent level was. I'm curious, what is that like? If you don't have an awareness that you're special at a sport, and then you come to a pretty high level, and I would imagine you're beating a lot of people. Did it seem natural? Was it, oh my God, this is awesome? Like, that seems to be an interesting place to be kind of mentally in a sport where you don't quite realize the strength of your powers.
I appreciate that question. No, it was not natural. I just did not like being in the spotlight. But at the same time, of course, it's nice when you get some pats on the back and that sort of thing. It definitely was just really good for my confidence to help me realize, you know, my work has paid off and, I could do even more than what I've been doing. So, yeah, no, it was not natural, but it was really good for me as an individual to kind of get comfortable in that kind of role, as a first year being number one, and then, you know, you have to play the number ones who are probably, you know, seniors at, these other Ivy Leagues or other New England teams in our conference, like Amherst, Williams, Bates. You want to be tested to see how, if your work is paying off and what you need to continue to work on. So it was really good for me to kind of be in that situation, just as far as giving myself some credit.
But I guess it also works in your favor from, and not to say you don't have an outstanding work ethic, but you constantly probably still feel like you have to keep battling, keep grinding, and you're not in that headspace where you think, oh, well, I got this one. I'm going to be, you know, I'm just better than this person. I've seen them play. Like, you're constantly working, so you've got this high level of talent / achievement, but not having rested on it, you're constantly pushing. Am I making sense in what I'm trying
Absolutely.
To get across?
Absolutely. Yeah. I just that's nice of you to say. I think that's just sort of that's what I focus on. I just have always, even though now I'm not playing competitively, I still see myself as a student of the game. And I have so much to learn. The game is always changing and I have so much to learn about it. And that goes for, you know, our teams as well here at Haverford. Of course, we're all students of the game. It never being enough is, I think, just where I'm always at. You know, I there's just so much more in the, to the game than I know. And I think that that hunger is what can help people really just get a lot better than they thought they could have, and not being complacent.
You had so much success at college. You're all over the record book. When you look back at your time as a squash player in college, whether it's, you know, specific matches or just moments, you know, with the team, playing with your brother the first couple years, what's kind of the depth chart of your college squash memories?
There are a lot of really good memories. When you ask that question, I think of, you know, the Bowdoin, the Lubin Squash Center, and just having those moments after training, you know, just hanging around with the team and stretching and cooling down and, you know, laughing and knowing that, you know, just having really good friends around me with those common interests. You know, I think that's always thinking about those moments are highlights. And, you know, also I have moments of, I had this one match when I was a first year, and the men's and women's teams traveled together, which they usually do. And I was just playing a incredibly close, exciting match against a rival. And I just remember I was so focused on my tactics and what I needed to be doing, but I remember being like pleasantly distracted by the like roaring Bowdoin crowd behind me. And, you know, I was a first year, so I was just trying to, you know, do my best and perform for the team, and just seeing them, the men's team and the women's team, just standing and cheering after winning specific points was really humbling, and definitely just something that pops into my mind when you mentioned that. So I think, you know, to answer that question, I have specific moments in matches where I feel like the team is behind me, but also just moments in general that are about, you know, being a part of a team. And yes, squash is an individual sport, but it became so much more fulfilling when I played for a team. And when I had all of these people with me, all of us trying to play for the same school and perform well for one thing much bigger than any of us individuals. And that's something that I find extremely fulfilling as a coach now, too. So I think really it comes down to the team aspect of my time at Bowdoin.
After Bowdoin, you continued to play. You played professionally for several years. And for people who aren't familiar, what does that mean? I think when people hear professional, they think, oh, well, there must be a team in Philadelphia, or there was a team in Boston. I get the idea. Is it more kind of you're a pro as an individual and you're competing in tournaments and all? Please correct me if I'm not giving the proper context.
You're exactly right.
But what is, kind of explain what it's like.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It is an individual endeavor. You play for your country, but you are traveling around the world, and you're playing, you're following the squash, the pro squash calendar. So there's a calendar year-round, and there's specific huge tournaments and certain tiered tournaments, smaller tiered, medium tiered and large tiered tournaments throughout the calendar. And you are, most people have a coach. I did not have a coach when I was playing pro. I was figuring it out on my own. But, you know, coaches usually determine which of the tournaments you're going to do in the calendar. And you might travel to Australia and play three weekends in a row in Brisbane and Melbourne and then Sydney, and then you'll travel to a different country and play the tournaments, the string of tournaments that are in that country. And they do that, you know, intentionally so that it makes sense for players to come to that event and play in several events. You know, I didn't do it for very long, but that is essentially how it works. And you train and you prepare for tournaments, and then you go to a tournament and compete, and then you get ready for the next one. And obviously there's different aspects of the calendar year where there's less tournaments. So there's less, you know, there's certain aspects of your training that you're doing less or more of, and then there's more of the busier time. So that is sort of how it works. And you're based somewhere. So you might be, you know, I was based in Philly and there were a lot of pros in this area. Working as teaching pros at a club, you know, doing the one-on-one thing, funding their travel through that. Pros might be based somewhere, like they might go to a city in Europe for 6 months and be based there because there's a lot of partners to train with in that area. And then they might bop around throughout the year just to get that training and to play in specific events.
Time for a break on One-on-One. We will have more with Haverford College head squash coach Nikki Clement right after this.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Come to DSW for the shoes, stay for the fun. Because, let's be honest, if shoe shopping isn't fun, are you even doing it right? So go ahead, try something new. Try something different. Good different. Try something that feels like you. You know, the real you. And then definitely brag about it later. Because at DSW, you've got unlimited freedom to play. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast. And if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a 2-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
Why does every recipe I try need 18 ingredients, including a jar of something paste I'll never use again but will sit in my fridge for 9 months? I just want dinner in the oven, fast. That's why I love Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals. They send you fresh ingredients that are already chopped. All you do is put it all together and bake. That's it. No chopping, no weird leftovers, just delicious, easy-to-make meals. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
And we are back. Our guest this week is Haverford College squash coach Nikki Clement. So you said you didn't have a coach. When you make the decision, first of all, was it an easy decision? Was it something that you were like, I want to try this, no question about it? Was it something that somebody mentioned to you, talked to you, and you found intriguing and came around? Without a coach, kind of, how'd you get started? Because that would seem overwhelming to me. You know, you're talking about all this travel, these tournaments, figuring out what tournament tier I should plug into, and what that's. I can only imagine, you know, at 22, 23, without a coach, who kind of let somebody had to kind of introduce you, lead you. Who was that person?
Yeah. So initially, someone had mentioned to me, you know, you should try pro, very casually. You should try going pro. And I thought, you know what, that sounds interesting. Because I could, one thing that, you know, I have alluded to it already, which is a big part of my squash passion, is I just, you know, I wanted to see how good I could get. And so I guess I started talking about it with my dad, and then he found, so there's this woman named Liz Irving. She is one of the best coaches in the world. She was the coach of the number one in the world, Nicole David from Malaysia, and Liz Irving. She was a former pro herself, number two in the world, and then she became a pro for a coach for pros. And she was full time working with Nicole, but she also would take in pros for several weeks at a time and kind of work with them and then send them on their way. And she was based in Amsterdam, and she had this situation in Amsterdam. So I think my dad had met Liz at some squash event or something, and he basically got me in touch with her, and I just went there. I just went to Amsterdam, and then I was there for 7 weeks, I think, and I was just a sponge. I learned everything I could. I wrote down everything that was said to me, and I learned how to train. I learned what a training plan looks like and what you need in it and those sorts of things. And so then I, you know, ran out of money. So I came back to Philly, and then I did that plan, and I just figured it out that way. I'm sure I would have had a lot more success if I had had some guidance, especially because I did tend to be someone who overtrained. And I didn't realize that until later that I was overtraining. That Liz Irving, she is the best coach I've ever spent time with. And a lot of people, feel that way. She really just, set me up in that way and taught me a lot more than just, how to hit the ball properly. Cause even at that point, I was still learning how to swing properly, because that's how amazing squash is. You know, the better you get, you still need to work on your swing a little bit. There's this aspect of your backswing or your wrist or your positioning. And that is why squash is so addicting to those who play it, because you're constantly working on getting better.
You've dropped names of, several really cool places that you went and played. Do you have a ballpark how many countries you've played in? Or how many countries you played in during your pro career?
Not that many. I only played for 2 years. I wasn't planning on it just being 2 years, but I got injured, and then I, got distracted by the appeal of the Haverford squash position that I heard about. But maybe 10, 15, really not that many. I did a lot of cities in, one country, 10, 15, maybe something like that. A lot of Central Europe, Western Europe, Central America, mainly.
What was your favorite place? What's the coolest place that you played, that you got to spend time to play squash? Like, is there any place that you're like, even to this day, I can't believe I got to spend 3 weeks there, or whatever the length of time was?
Definitely. That would be Melbourne, Australia, for a lot of reasons. The people are awesome. They are so kind and generous and happy. So the people made a huge difference. The people that I was spending time with and traveling with and training with. And the city itself it's beautiful and unique. And it has a big art and music influence, and it's exciting and thrilling, and the food is delicious. I definitely felt that way when I was there. I can't believe I'm here. This is so fun. And I, have always, and those players that I met there, they're still saying to me, hey, when are you going to come back and visit? There's such cool people there. They're so welcoming, and, you're always invited back, which is just pretty cool.
At the other end of the spectrum, because I talk to a lot of specifically basketball players who go overseas to play, and they'll have a lot of great stories. But then they'll also have places that they play where, well, I had to get out before the government fell, or, you know, I had to make sure I got to the bank by 4 o'clock because we knew only the first six checks were going to cash from this team, you know, stuff like that. Was there anything at the other end of the spectrum that was a little, maybe not scary, but just like, this is nice, but I'm not coming back here?
Not really. I mean, I think I was just so excited to be in new places and see what they had to offer. They meaning the people and the city and the club that I was training at. And I mean, not really. I just, every single place was super cool and different. And I don't think so. I just was so excited about every opportunity that was there. And, you know, I think I really did go to some great places. So, yeah.
You mentioned the injury after a couple of years. What was it, something you thought was going to be a crossroads injury, but you mentioned the Haverford position. Was it kind of the marriage of you get hurt and, oh, here's a way I could stay in squash and this is intriguing to me, kind of where, how'd that come together?
Definitely. So when I was in college, I interned for the athletic director, and I remember thinking maybe athletic administration in the D3 level is the thing for me. So I had thought that maybe that was something that I would get to anyway. And I had done, all I did was Google athletic directors and read their bios. And they all at the time, all of them had a similar formula, which was you start out as a coach and then you start to get involved in the administrative side of the department and that sort of thing. So I already had that in my head. And I thought, you know, and I had had such a good time as a team member in my college experience that I already had that in my head. But I wanted to try out pro. So I was playing pro, and you know, the way that I described that injury made it sound like it was ominous. It was harmless. It was plantar fasciitis. Okay. And it was so, so bad. I had ignored it for so long that I finally just couldn't walk. And so I thought, okay, I guess I have to handle this. So anybody who has plantar fasciitis knows you have to do rigorous PT. If you really want to get rid of it, you have to do PT all day long. So I was just doing PT. I think I had already done a season at Haverford as the head coach, and I was sort of trying to play pro at the same time. And it was very, you just cannot do two full-time things. And one of them kind of had to give way. And I was, you know, not doing that many tournaments and that sort of thing. And so I was rehabbing it was 2 or 3 months that I was rehabbing, and I realized being away, I obviously couldn't hit at that time. And I had realized, that I really missed the game in a way that I had not in a really long time, because when I had started playing pro, I had gotten intense to the point that I was, my priorities had gotten out of line, and I wanted to do well and results mattered and I had to play perfectly. And this training session had to be perfect, and nobody is perfect. So the minute it was not perfect, I would get, you know, frustrated with myself. And so I was dealing with some overtraining and perspective struggles when I was in the heat of playing pro. And again, if you have a coach, I think they would have caught that early and it wouldn't have happened. But I was just, you know, trying to figure it out. So when I had to sit and not play, I remembered how much I loved squash. I had forgotten. And I remembered how much I loved squash. And I thought, wow, I did not balance this right with pro. And so when I finally was able to start hitting again, I was so happy to be on court. And I realized, you know, I do probably want to get back to playing pro, but not yet, because I'm really enjoying what I'm doing at Haverford. And I got to be smart about the way I approach it again. And I just kind of thought about that. And for the next couple of years, people would ask me, oh, are you going to, you know, join the circuit again? Are you going to join the pro circuit again? And I would have like a twinge of like sadness because I wanted to, but I also was like, I'm just not sure that I can. And it sort of just then sort of did not become the priority that it was. And so it sort of happened that way. I sort of would be interested, you know, at the time, and of course, probably still now, I'd be curious about joining the tour. That would not work out right now. But, you know, I, of course, think about that stuff and was thinking about it. But it just sort of naturally, I started really loving what I was doing with the teams. And, you know, I'd love to try pro again, but I'm really interested in what I'm doing at Haverford right now. So we'll see. And that's sort of how that happened.
How specifically the door at Haverford? What was the connection that, you know, that brought you in the door at Haverford?
Right. So I grew up in the area. I grew up a couple miles from Haverford. And I never really, you know, I ran the nature trail when I was younger and stuff like that. And my great grandfather and grandfather went here. So I always knew about it and everything, but the coach at the time, the coach of the Haverford squash team, and it was a part-time position. That coach was coaching men's tennis and men's and women's squash. So it was very he just couldn't prioritize it. But he had said, you know, he was thinking of retiring, and he had reached out to me and he said, you should look at this position, because he had known me from college. So that's sort of how that happened. He had suggested it. And then I realized, especially after a year or two at Haverford working with the players there, I realized that the squash program and the students here, what they, prioritized and what they cared about was directly in line with what I prioritized and cared about. So, it was a little bit fortuitous in that way too.
And this is 2010-ish?
Yes.
And you get you're head coach of the men and the women both from the jump, correct?
Correct.
What kind of challenge is that? Because, I mean, you could probably argue it's kind of all one program, but it's two separate programs, two separate schedules, two separate rosters. Was that a lot at first, or did it? I'm sure it's still a lot now, but I mean, I would imagine at first that could seem almost overwhelming.
It's a lot. It was a lot, but I didn't really think of, I just didn't think about that. I was just grinding, I guess. And I really loved and still love both programs. Both programs offer different things and, to me as a coach, but you know, I think also at the time, not as much, it's still happening a bit, but when I was in college, a lot of squash coaches and tennis coaches were dual coaches. So they would coach the men's and the women's programs. Yes, it's a lot. I feel like a lot of the times I'm just doing things times two, and that's okay because I enjoy it. And yeah, I mean, it is a lot, but I do get a lot from both programs. So I guess I like being really busy.
Is it something that you're able, for the most part, that the tasks you have to do mirror each other? You just have to do them twice, if that makes sense. Like you have to, you're just double the workload, or are there challenges and things that are specific to the men's team or specific to the women's team that don't overlap?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of things that do overlap. And so I'm not actually doing everything times two, but a lot of things I can, a lot of tasks or scheduling and, you know, a lot of admin stuff ends up being, I'm able to do both, cover the needs of both teams at once. But, you know, to answer your question a little that you mentioned a second ago, I think that some coaches who are dual coaches could kind of see it as one program and kind of have their program function as one. But I sort of guess that I sort of see them as two different programs because they're two different teams and they have different, we have different practices and different, entirely different group dynamics in each. So there is a lot of overlap, but there are kind of the aspects of what make differentiate the two teams are probably what make it interesting also.
Are there any challenges being a woman coaching a men's team? We see a lot of men that coach women's teams in sports across. Having a woman coach a men's team, it seems like it is more, it happens more in squash maybe than you see in a lot of other sports. But does it present any challenges?
Not really. I don't really see that kind of thing as but I think I have different challenges with coaching women. You know, I think that coaching an individual, regardless of gender, is not that different. Coaching a group of men is, and coaching a group of women, that's probably different, like a group together and how just men and women communicate, and how they function and, you know, non-verbally kind of, work together or whatever. So I think there's differences, but I think I've been very lucky that when I came to Haverford, the men's team was, they just wanted to get good. That's what mattered. They wanted to get good. And, I wanted to help them get good. And that's what it was about. It was just not about that. It's just not really a thought. It's not really relevant at all. You know, it's just we're working on getting good at this craft. And that's what it's about.
Time for another break on One-on-One. We will have more with Haverford College men's and women's squash head coach Nikki Clement right after this. And we are back. Our guest on One-on-One this week is Haverford College head men's and women's squash coach Nikki Clement. I'm curious, do you think your relationship with your brother and your squash, and when I say relationship, I mean like your squash relationship, do you think that has helped make it seem like this is just life and I'm coaching you, I coach this team, we're playing squash? Because it would seem like you have a connection that makes that dynamic seem much more like this is not anything out of the unusual. Do you ever thought about that?
That makes sense. I mean, I think like with most sports, and it's, you know, getting better and better as time goes on. But when I was younger, like most sports, there were more men playing than women or more boys playing than more girls. So a lot of my clinics when I was young were like 80% boys. And like, I was the only girl. So I was definitely used to that. And then you're right, playing with my dad and playing with my brother constantly played a role for sure. And, you know, I remember at Bowdoin, I had like I just remember this moment. I was, you know, with, there had been a training session and we were all just stretching after practice. And I remember thinking like, I'm the only girl here. And that's so normal. Like I had never noticed it before. Until that moment, I was like, this is how it always is. And that's interesting. It was just an observation. So I think maybe that some of that stuff did play a role. It's, you know, it's about the game and it's really not about anything else.
How much of a challenge is it? Because the seasons go on simultaneously, correct? The men's season and the women's season. How much of a challenge is it for you as a coach? Men are doing well, women aren't. Or women are doing well, men aren't. Men are disappointing. Women are the women's team's overachieving. How difficult is it for you to balance the type of coach you need to be, you know, with these two separate teams going on simultaneously? I mean, sure, it'd be great if they were both chasing championships at the same time, but that's not probably realistic. So you have to be maybe Coach A to make sure this group's in the right headspace, but you need to take a different approach with these kids who maybe are excelling at the moment, and you just kind of have to make sure that that continues.
Yeah. I mean, both teams are always doing so well. I've got to say that. I've been here for a long time and I just am so, so lucky with the group of kids that I get every year. Every year I have moments in practice and I'm like, can't believe we got these people. They are so great. And that's the case on both sides. I think that question, when you ask that question, it makes me think more of like recruiting. I feel like if I'm focused on recruiting women, then sometimes I neglect a little bit of recruiting for the men. And then I've been recruiting for the men a little bit, and then I've neglected a little bit. So that's where I feel kind of that seesaw feeling. And you know, I don't know, I guess as far as the question regarding coaching, I think I'm just so used to separating them completely. I don't really compare them. I'm focused on the women's team when I'm with the women's team and what we need to do. And then I'm focused on the men's team and what they need to do.
How long did it take you to find your pace just from a logistics time management standpoint when dealing with two different teams? I mean, was that something tough that, you know, you had to, you know, balance that kind of stuff, or did it just kind of come natural and you found your workflow pretty easily?
Yeah, it was natural. I had those habits already. I had the habits of making the best of your time. I'm not great at it all the time, but I think I just built those skills in, you know, at a young age, being really busy in high school, playing, you know, multiple sports and being serious about multiple sports, but also having to do well on this paper that I have to turn in. And, you know, so maybe just building those skills earlier and then needing them in college and then, you know, needing them ever since. I probably had some of those habits from earlier in my life.
You've had so much success at Haverford on both sides. The question I asked you about your college days, and obviously you're still in the midst of your coaching, but to this point, if I asked you, what's at the top of your favorite memories, most proud achievements as the coach at Haverford, what would be at the top of the list?
There are so many. There are so many great memories, and they're not always, you know, titles and accolades and those sort of things, but like small moments. I mean, this sounds so obscure, but when you ask that question, the first thing that I thought of was, you know, one time we were playing a team that we were very close with in level, and our number one was playing. So there's nine in college squash. There are nine matches that count towards the final score. So you have a number one through to a number nine, and those matches count towards the score. But you have additional players, of course. You have a 10, 11, 12, 13, however big your roster is. And we had our number one playing, and we also, it was the end of the match. I honestly don't even remember if we had won or lost, just because I can't remember. I think it was really, really close and we had won and everyone was in such a great mood. Or maybe we hadn't won yet. I just can't remember, but our number one was on. And a lot of time the number one, it gets a lot of fans and people want to watch the number one and that sort of thing. So the number one was playing, but the number 11, was also playing, because sometimes the 10, the 11, they get, exhibition matches if we have time. I think tennis does that as well. I'm not sure actually, but squash just kind of, if we have the court space and the time, we try to get those extra matches in so that those other kids get matches. So our number one was playing and everybody's, you know, watching and cheering. And our number 11 was playing right next door at at the court next door. And I had noticed that 50% of our team was watching the one and 50% of our team was watching and cheering on the 11. And I was just so proud, because that is such a, I think that is what our team has always been about. It doesn't matter what number you play, your match matters. Your match matters to us. And we want you to have a great experience, and we want you to play really well and see if you can in your match do some of the things we've been working on. And I didn't even have to say, you know, anything. 50% of the team really wanted to see how the 11 was doing. 50% wanted to see how the one was doing. So It's not exactly what you asked, but that is something that I was really proud of. And, you know, moments like that, just seeing, you know, two players, you know, I'm thinking of two players who butted heads their freshman year when they were first years. They had nothing in common. They did not get along. By their senior year, they were really good friends, not because either of them had changed any aspect of their personality. They had found common ground through the game, through squash. And now I know that they're alums and they're really good friends. And those are the kinds of moments that I am so proud to be a part of, to have witnessed and to have seen. So yes, of course, when we won titles for the women's team, when we won our division for the women's side, and when we won our division for the men's side, both times, those are such awesome memories. But some of these other ones are make me feel the same way.
When it comes, and I don't mean this directly to you, but the squash community as a whole, when it comes to growing the game, you mentioned the Philadelphia, the center that's in Philadelphia. What are the hurdles to getting squash to more people, to opening more doors? Because I would think there are some challenges for some communities when it comes to access, maybe, you know, being able to pay to play, but the opportunities. What are some of the challenges and how do those start to get remedied?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question, because it's important. Squash has to be accessible to more people. It's changing more and more as time goes on. But when I was, you know, in high school, there weren't that many public courts. There were a lot of private clubs that had squash programs, and they were expensive to be a part of. And so there wasn't a lot of opportunity for socioeconomic diversity and access to courts. And it's really changed. There's this incredible urban mentoring structure that a lot of squash communities have created, where they create they get the funding for a squash facility, or they have access to a club, and they bring in students from middle school from different lower socioeconomic statuses, and they bring them in and they give them mentoring on the court and tutoring in school. And that is starting kids in middle school allows them to have opportunities to play in college. So that is, you know, there's all kinds of, the one in Philly is called Squash Smarts, and there are all kinds of urban mentoring programs around the country that are popping up all the time. So those are huge. And those are just such wonderful things for the sport. But it needs to be accessible. I know that, you know, Manhattan had somewhere in Manhattan, I haven't been to it, but there is a public court outside and you can just go on it. I mean, I know that's the case with a sport like basketball. And it would be incredible if that were the case for squash. So there is an endeavor to really build public courts and to just have them around and where people can just kind of walk on. And it's really only this country where squash in its history has not been as accessible, but it really is getting better. The last 20 years, it's really, really gotten better. So, you know, we need public courts around. And like I said, there's more and more of those popping up all the time.
And my final question, all you've accomplished in squash, player, coach, Haverford, around the world, I asked you kind of your favorite memory, but what are you most proud of? Everything you've done, the people you've mentored, everything you've coached, right at the top, what are you most proud of?
That's tough. I don't know what's at the top, Matt, but there's a couple things kind of bobbing around at the top. That I'm most proud of. When I think of Haverford, I think of the squash alumni network and how big that has become, and how there is such a huge camaraderie between the players who currently play and then leave Haverford and go on and live their lives, but stay connected and come back every year for our alumni match and have, you know, group texts going on all day, all year long, and just having, you know, I feel proud that the Haverford squash community has just exponentially grown into what it is. People that are passionate about it still call Haverford home, even if they've graduated years ago. That's something I'm proud of. I honestly think that's probably what it would be.
Nikki Clement, thanks so much for taking the time. Hope you enjoyed this as much as I did.
I really did, Matt. Thanks so much.
And that will do it for this week's episode. Want to thank Nikki Clement, the head men's and women's squash coach at Haverford College, for being our guest this week. Now, if you like this show and you listen on Apple Podcasts, you can do us a big favor by leaving us a rating and a review. Now, you can follow the show on Twitter at @OneOnOnePod. You can follow me on Twitter as well at @MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to join us again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Holiday PSA from DSW. This is your reminder that shoes are a gift. Literally. So unwrap something good. Like boots that inspire your next big adventure. Or cozy slippers that give you an excuse to stay in. Or sneakers that feel like pure joy. Because shoes aren't just shoes, they're exactly what you wanted. Let us surprise you, so you can surprise them. Find shoes that get you, and everyone on your list, at prices that get your budget. At DSW stores or DSW.com.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second, and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered. It's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
Why does every recipe I try need 18 ingredients, including a jar of something paste I'll never use again but will sit in my fridge for 9 months? I just want dinner in the oven, fast. That's why I love Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals. They send you fresh ingredients that are already chopped. All you do is put it all together and bake. That's it. No chopping, no weird leftovers, just delicious, easy-to-make meals. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
And we are back. Our guest on One-on-One this week is Haverford College head men's and women's squash coach Nikki Clement. I'm curious, do you think your relationship with your brother and your squash, and when I say relationship, I mean like your squash relationship, do you think that has helped make it seem like this is just life and I'm coaching you, I coach this team, we're playing squash? Because it would seem like you have a connection that makes that dynamic seem much more like this is not anything out of the unusual. Do you ever thought about that?
That makes sense. I mean, I think like with most sports, and it's, you know, getting better and better as time goes on. But when I was younger, like most sports, there were more men playing than women, or more boys playing than more girls. So a lot of my clinics when I was young were like 80% boys. And like, I was the only girl. So I was definitely used to that. And then you're right, playing with my dad and playing with my brother constantly played a role for sure. And, you know, I remember at Bowdoin, I had like I just remember this moment. I was, you know, with, there had been a training session and we were all just stretching after practice. And I remember thinking like, I'm the only girl here. And that's so normal. Like I had never noticed it before until that moment. I was like, this is how it always is. And that's interesting. It was just an observation. So I think maybe that some of that stuff did play a role. It's, you know, it's about the game and it's really not about anything else.
How much of a challenge is it? Because the seasons go on simultaneously, correct? The men's season and the women's season. How much of a challenge is it for you as a coach? Men are doing well, women aren't. Or women are doing well, men aren't. Men are disappointing. Women are the women's team's overachieving. How difficult is it for you to balance the type of coach you need to be, you know, with these two separate teams going on simultaneously? I mean, sure, it'd be great if they were both chasing championships at the same time, but that's not probably realistic. So you have to be maybe Coach A to make sure this group's in the right headspace, but you need to take a different approach with these kids who maybe are excelling at the moment, and you just kind of have to make sure that that continues.
Yeah. I mean, both teams are always doing so well. I've got to say that. I've been here for a long time and I just am so, so lucky with the group of kids that I get every year. Every year I have moments in practice and I'm like, can't believe we got these people. They are so great. And that's the case on both sides. I think that question, when you ask that question, it makes me think more of like recruiting. I feel like if I'm focused on recruiting women, then sometimes I neglect a little bit of recruiting for the men. And then I've been recruiting for the men a little bit, and then I've neglected a little bit. So that's where I feel kind of that seesaw feeling. You know, I don't know. I guess as far as the question regarding coaching, I think I'm just so used to separating them completely. I don't really compare them. I'm focused on the women's team when I'm with the women's team and what we need to do. And then I'm focused on the men's team and what they need to do.
How long did it take you to find your pace just from a logistics time management standpoint when dealing with two different teams? I mean, was that something tough that, you know, you had to, you know, balance that kind of stuff, or did it just kind of come natural and you found your workflow pretty easily?
Yeah, it was natural. I had those habits already. I had the habits of making the best of your time. I'm not great at it all the time, but I think I just built those skills in, you know, at a young age, being really busy in high school, playing, you know, multiple sports and being serious about multiple sports, but also having to do well on this paper that I have to turn in. And, you know, so maybe just building those skills earlier and then needing them in college and then, you know, needing them ever since. I probably had some of those habits from earlier in my life.
You've had so much success at Haverford on both sides. The question I asked you about your college days, and obviously you're still in the midst of your coaching, but to this point, if I asked you, what's at the top of your favorite memories, most proud achievements as the coach at Haverford, what would be at the top of the list?
There are so many. There are so many great memories, and they're not always, you know, titles and accolades and those sort of things, but like small moments. I mean, this sounds so obscure, but when you ask that question, the first thing that I thought of was, you know, one time we were playing a team that we were very close with in level, and Our number one was playing. So there's nine in college squash. There are nine matches that count towards the final score. So you have a number one through to a number nine, and those matches count towards the score. But you have additional players, of course. You have a 10, 11, 12, 13, however big your roster is. And we had our number one playing, and we also, it was the end of the match. I honestly don't even remember if we had won or lost, just because I can't remember. I think it was really, really close and we had won, and everyone was in such a great mood. Or maybe we hadn't won yet. I just can't remember, but our number one was on. And a lot of time the number one, it gets a lot of fans and people want to watch the number one and that sort of thing. So the number one was playing, but the number 11, was also playing, because sometimes the 10, the 11, they get, exhibition matches if we have time. I think tennis does that as well. I'm not sure actually, but squash just kind of, if we have the court space and the time, we try to get those extra matches in so that those other kids get matches. So our number one was playing and everybody's, you know, watching and cheering. And our number 11 was playing right next door at a, you know, at the court next door. And I had noticed that 50% of our team was watching the one, and 50% of our team was watching and cheering on the 11. And I was just so proud, because that is such a, I think that is what our team has always been about. It doesn't matter what number you play, your match matters. Your match matters to us, and we want you to have a great experience, and we want you to play really well and see if you can in your match do some of the things we've been working on. And I didn't even have to say, you know, anything. 50% of the team really wanted to see how the 11 was doing. 50% wanted to see how the one was doing. So it's not exactly what you asked, but that is something that I was really proud of. And you know, moments like that, just seeing, you know, two players, you know, I'm thinking of two players who butted heads their first year when they were first years. They had nothing in common. They did not get along. By their senior year, they were really good friends, not because either of them had changed any aspect of their personality. They had found common ground through the game, through squash. And now I know that they're alums, and they're really good friends. And those are the kinds of moments that I am so proud to be a part of, to have witnessed and to have seen. So, yes, of course, when we won titles for the women's team, when we won our division for the women's side, and when we won our division for the men's side, both times, those are such awesome memories. But some of these other ones are make me feel the same way.
When it comes, and I don't mean this directly to you, but the squash community as a whole, when it comes to growing the game, you mentioned the Philadelphia, the center that's in Philadelphia. What are the hurdles to getting squash to more people, to opening more doors? 'Cause I would think there are some challenges for some communities when it comes to access, maybe, you know, being able to the opportunities. What are some of the challenges, and how do those get remedied?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question, because it's important. Squash has to be accessible to more people. It's changing more and more as time goes on, but when I was, you know, in high school, there weren't that many public courts. There were a lot of private clubs that had squash programs, and they were expensive to be a part of. And so there wasn't a lot of opportunity for socioeconomic diversity and access to courts. And it's really changed. There's this incredible urban mentoring structure that a lot of squash communities have created, where they create they get the funding for a squash facility, or they have access to a club, and they bring in students from middle school from different lower socioeconomic statuses, and they bring them in and they give them mentoring on the court and tutoring in school. And that is starting kids in middle school allows them to have opportunities to play in college. So that is, you know, there's all kinds of, the one in Philly is called Squash Smarts, and there are all kinds of urban mentoring programs around the country that are popping up all the time. So those are huge, and those are just such wonderful things for the sport. But it needs to be accessible. I know that, you know, Manhattan had somewhere in Manhattan, I haven't been to it, but there is a public court outside and you can just go on it. I mean, I know that's the case with a sport like basketball. And it would be incredible if that were the case for squash. So there is an endeavor to really build public courts and to just have them around and where people can just kind of walk on. And it's really only this country where squash in its history has not been as accessible, but it really is getting better. The last 20 years, it's really, really gotten better. So, you know, we need public courts around. And like I said, there's more and more of those popping up all the time.
And my final question, all you've accomplished in squash, player, coach, Haverford, around the world, I ask you kind of your favorite memory, but what are you most proud of? Everything you've done, the people you've mentored, everything you've coached, right at the top, what are you most proud of?
That's tough. I don't know what's at the top, Matt, but there's a couple things kind of bobbing around at the top. That I'm most proud of. When I think of Haverford, I think of the squash alumni network and how big that has become, and how there is such a huge camaraderie between the players who currently play and then leave Haverford and go on and live their lives, but stay connected and come back every year for our alumni match and have, you know, group texts going on all day, all year long, and just having, you know, I feel proud that the Haverford squash community has just exponentially grown into what it is. People that are passionate about it still call Haverford home, even if they've graduated years ago. That's something I'm proud of. I honestly think that's probably what it would be.
Nikki Clement, thanks so much for taking the time. Hope you enjoyed this as much as I did.
I really did, Matt. Thanks so much.
And that will do it for this week's episode. Want to thank Nikki Clement, the head men's and women's squash coach at Haverford College, for being our guest this week. Now, if you like this show and you listen on Apple Podcasts, you could do us a big favor by leaving us a rating and a review. Now, you can follow the show on Twitter at @OneOnOnePod. You can follow me on Twitter as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to join us again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered. It's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This holiday season, choose gifts that feel thoughtful and practical with Omaha Steaks. Whether you're hosting or gifting, they deliver the world's best steak experience. And it makes you look like you planned way ahead. They've got USDA-certified tender steaks, juicy burgers, comfort meals, and tons more. Gifting Omaha Steaks is honestly one of the easiest wins. Everything arrives beautifully packaged, super convenient, and the quality is unbelievable. Their filet mignons are some of the most tender I've ever had. And the variety means you can personalize every gift. Plus, orders placed by 6 p.m. Eastern ship same day. And everything is backed by their 100% guarantee. It's holiday gifting made simple. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their Sizzle All The Way sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code T-Bone at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, code T-Bone.
Find new customers on a platform that's here to stay. With TikTok for Business, anything is possible. If you've ever thought about advertising your business on TikTok, now is the time to do it. You can drive more customers to your website, sell products right in the app, and you can even use TikTok's creative tools to easily make content and find creators to help sell your products for you. Find new customers today. Just open your browser, type in getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads, and grow your business fast.